Senate Bill 502. And I believe Senator Miller, you
Senator
have...
Senator Wally Miller.
Senator Wally, or is it... Or is it... I get them mixed up. Is it... What's his name? Randy...
Oh, yeah, it's...
I get my Randys mixed up. I know, and I don't want to hear anything about Senator Tom either.
No, I can tell now that you've started frosting your hair again, Mr. Chairman.
And I'd like to ask you to try to do a good job here this afternoon, because I tell you what, it's really hard to stay awake on an afternoon like this.
It's beautiful, huh?
It's a beautiful afternoon, and I've got a committee that... We'd rather be outside than listening to you, Senator.
I've got to tell you, Mr. Chair.
I can't imagine any afternoon you wouldn't prefer that. But.
Senator Miller has his own rooting section here for this bill, and consequently nothing in my office is getting done since he's here.
Oh, I see. We'll be quick about it.
I will do my best.
We really do welcome you to the committee, and we're glad
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Delighted to be back. For the record, State Senator Randy Miller, District 13, here to testify in support of Senate Bill 502. As this bill was before a fairly similar committee a couple of months back, I hopefully won't be redundant, but let me just suggest that the essence of this bill would be to allow the Department of Transportation to adjust speed limits on our state highways, and it would set the maximum that could be fixed on a signpost at 75 miles per hour. The current maximum now allowed is 65. There is no requirement in this bill that says to the Department of Transportation, you must post 75 anywhere, and I would significantly doubt that that would be the case. 2 years ago, when this bill passed both chambers, the Department of Transportation went so far as to create a markup of different highways in the state, and the number I saw, for the most part, was 70 on I-5 and I-84. There was a little stretch, I recall, in far eastern Oregon where they probably got you acquainted with what it's like in Idaho, and you were allowed to go 75. But the safeguards in this bill are, frankly, that it's flexible, and it requires that the Department of Transportation would consult with local jurisdictions where there might be merging, like here in Salem, where there's a lot of activity on and off the freeway, where it may make sense to restrict speeds, as is done now at 55. I don't quarrel with that. We've seen the Department of Transportation, I think, take appropriate action when they reduce speeds in the Twilliger curves down to 50, even though it is authorized to be 55. I would also suggest that there are parts of this state where it makes absolutely no sense to set the limit at 65, which is at least 5 miles per hour below what it was 30 years ago when these freeways, 40 years ago when these freeways were built and cars weren't nearly as good. And there weren't the restraints we have in those automobiles. There weren't the kinds of tires we have and other considerations and engineering advances that have been made. So I know that so oftentimes this bill is reported as raising speed limits, but I want to assure you, Mr. Chairman, that would be a decision for the Department of Transportation after talking with the local jurisdictions, the state police, traffic safety groups, organizations who might express concerns, the engineers who build the highways, to say whether or not an adjustment ought to be made. And that's pretty much it.
Yes, Senator Cole.
And legally,
mm-hmm.
What's the difference between authorizes and shall?
Authorizes simply is a flexible kind of a permitting process, I would suggest, to the Department of Transportation. It'll be their decision. This does not fix into statute, does not require them, because I didn't believe there was one size speed limit that was good for all of our highways. I just don't think that's true, and I think we have the wherewithal to judge what is reasonable in certain areas. And that would be the other thing that you might encounter this afternoon, a discussion between basic rule and maximum speed limits. As I'm sure you're well acquainted with, Mr. Chairman, the basic rule simply says that you can drive what is a reasonable and safe speed given the circumstances, and that number that is posted is the presumed reasonable and safe speed. But it is a rebuttable presumption in the law, meaning that if you are exceeding that by 5 miles per hour, beautiful day, you could, if you were interested, contest a citation you might have received under those circumstances, and a judge could agree with you that your exceeding the number by, say, 5 miles per hour was reasonable behavior given the conditions, and the ticket would be excused. On the other hand, a maximum speed limit, the only issue is, did you exceed the number? It doesn't matter how reasonable you were, it's just a fixed arbitrary number, and you would be presumed and quite likely found guilty if you conceded that you exceeded the number.
Senator, I have a question now, because I know this issue of maximum and basic rule becomes a big issue. Okay, and you were using the term, you're using the figure 5 miles over. Now, it's my understanding, with basic rule, it's conceivable you could be 15 miles over. And I think maybe our state police will be here to can answer that question a bit later, too. But I guess let's assume that you've set the speed limit at 75. And you just say 75. You don't say maximum 75, right, in your
correct
plan. Okay, if you say that and you're driving, and let's say it is a clear day, you know, so conceivably you could be going 87 miles an hour on, well, if it's posted to 75, would that not be the case?
Under the basic rule?
Yes, with the basic rule. Because you're leaving the basic rule.
The same conditions would exist in the minds of the enforcement. If you are driving at an unreasonable rate of speed given the circumstances, any deviation from the posted number in their minds would be a cause to cite you for driving in an unreasonable manner. It's a rebuttable presumption. You can argue it. You cannot argue a violation of the maximum speed, if indeed you admitted that you were going 1 mile per hour over that number. And I would suggest, too, that at the higher speeds, judges are probably less likely to agree that your behavior was reasonable in the circumstance you cite, that where you're going 87 in a 75, because I think most motorists would agree that probably 75 is about the maximum of what's reasonable. There may be some variation in that, based, you know, if it's wide open, nothing out there, perhaps you've got some defense. But in the usual circumstances, certainly I-5, that's not going to be the case. I don't think any judge is going to suggest that 87 is reasonable.
Other questions for Senator Miller while he's here? Is it going to get off that easy? Good. Well, I think in that case, Senator, I don't know if you have to get back, you're welcome to stay here when I bring...
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the committee's time. And
thank you very much, too.
Consideration.
Okay. You're welcome to stay there if you'd like.
Chairman Harper requested my presence. Unless I'll stay for a little bit and see if there's...
But, yeah, it might be helpful if you have a minute. Let me call... Bob Russell from the Oregon Trucking Association. Good afternoon, Bob. Would you identify yourself, please, for the record?
Certainly. Good afternoon. My name is Bob Russell. I'm Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Association. And first, let me say that we really applaud Senator Miller's effort. And we agree that speed on rural interstates should be increased. However, having said that, the trucking industry is very concerned if truck speed exceeds 65 miles an hour. That's our policy, is that's the maximum speed limit for trucks on rural interstates. We also have done a number of studies, as a matter of fact, AAA has done a number of studies that indicate that the differential between cars and trucks is an important safety factor. If the differential speed between cars and trucks is 10 miles an hour or more, there are much more likely to be sideswipe and rear-end accidents. And it's the car sideswiping and rear-ending the truck that occurs. Matter of fact, the Federal Highway Administration has noted that when the speed differentials exist, it is 4 times more likely that a car will hit a truck. So our policy has been that no trucks no more than 65 and no more than a 5-mile-an-hour differential. So what that would mean is maximum car speed at 70, maximum truck speed at 65. We believe that those limits are in the best interest of highway safety for all users, trucks and cars alike. As an aside, since Senator Miller brought it up, we would support a change from the basic rule to a maximum speed limit. One of the things that has happened to our members is that they're treated differently depending on which court they're cited into, and that they sort of view that as being discriminatory, and they would prefer to know what the rules of the road are and be treated the same everywhere. So we would support that. It's not something that we would break our pick on, however. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Russell.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, as you know, I live on the coast where the driving conditions vary dramatically from fog to rain to everything else. And so I have a real problem with the maximum speed, but would you, when you say maximum speed, I want to make it very clear that you're talking about cars and trucks with a maximum speed, or would the trucking industry be interested in a maximum speed for trucks, but basic rule for cars?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Messerly, we're okay either way. We do have some problems with the different ways the courts treat us under the basic rule. And I think that when we're contemplating a maximum speed, what we're talking about is a maximum speed in good conditions. If conditions aren't good, then I think that it would be prudent for people to slow down. And I'm assuming that portion of the basic rule would still be in place if the maximum speed was 65 and the fog limited your visibility to 15 feet, I think that you should be cited if you were going 65 in those conditions.
Chair, follow up.
Yes,
Mr. Messerly. And I also want to speak to the difference in speeds between cars and trucks. I feel very strongly that any difference in speed is dangerous. And the wider that, as I agree with your testimony, that the wider that differential is, the worse it gets. But, you know, from the efficiencies, the moving in and out of traffic, all the different aspects, it really does create a hazard on the freeways especially.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Messerly, I agree with you. The most current study I have was done in the state of Arizona in 2000, and their clear recommendation was that there be no differential. However, I've got 19 different studies, and when you look at all 19, statistically, there is a higher instance of accidents when the differential is 10 miles an hour or more. That's not true with the 5-mile-an-hour differential. One of the reasons that the trucking industry is saying we're okay with the 5-mile-an-hour differential is because we can understand why an automobile driver may want to go 70, but we really don't want trucks going that fast. And so we're not trying to impose our limit on automobile drivers because we feel very strongly that trucks shouldn't be going over 65.
Other questions for Bob right now? Okay, I'm going to ask, why don't you stay there, Bob? I'm going to ask Lynn Chastain from the Oregon State Police to come forward and join the table if you don't mind. Kind of expedite this a little bit here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Glenn Chastain, and I'm with the Oregon State Police, assigned out of our Patrol Services Division. Senate Bill 502 received a hearing before the Senate Transportation Committee back in March. After that hearing, proposed amendments to the Senate bill were drafted. The amendments were not heard because the Senate Transportation Committee was closed down. Approximately that same time, House Bill 3840 was being heard in the House Transportation Committee. The proposed amendments to Senate Bill 502 were incorporated into that bill. The House Bill 3840 has passed out of committee and is referred to Ways and Means where it is at this time. The proposed amendments to Senate Bill 502 do a couple of things. First, it cleans up our current speed laws by repealing sections that are no longer applicable in Oregon and removes language that refers to those new sections that are being repealed. The proposed amendment would make Oregon speed laws much easier to understand for the motoring public and for law enforcement. Secondly, the Governor's Office, the Oregon State Police, and the Department of Transportation have all worked with legislative counsel on these amendments and support the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 502. This support is contingent upon the number of troopers being negotiated in the budget process, and given the timing of this session, it will be critical that the process to review this policy proceeds now. The proposed amendment changes several aspects of our speed laws. It removes the rural versus urban language and treats all highways the same. It deletes all references to the federal maximum speed limit, which is no longer applicable. It authorizes an increase in the maximum interstate speed limit to 70 miles an hour for cars and 60 miles an hour for trucks. It places a maximum limit on all other highways not greater than 60 miles an hour. It places speed limits on all highways and roads in the state. It retains the violation of the basic rule for those circumstances in which speeds lower than the posted speed limit would constitute an unsafe speed. Retains default speed limits for areas that are not posted with signage. It incorporates an enhanced penalty for violation of speed limits on those highways with speed limits of 60 miles an hour or greater. And last, the Oregon Department of Transportation's study of highways will change to include consultation with the Oregon State Police and the Emergency Medical Services. We believe that the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 502 will improve Oregon speed laws and will make them much easier for everybody to understand. Should you pass Senate Bill 502 in its amended version, we would ask that you would send it to Ways and Means so it can be considered with House Bill 3840. Thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for him at this point? Senator Miller, do you want to come up and do you have any comments about the Dash 1 amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. State Senator Randy Miller again. What I alerted you to earlier still stands, that the imposition of the maximums as the exclusive citation on the rural interstates makes no sense. And I was listening to the presentation about how this was apparently going to simplify things, and I see that it still retained maximums and basic rule for speeds lower than the posted number. The basic rule makes sense for speeds lower and above the posted speed. It's a sound rule, ought to remain in our statutes for both conditions, and we don't, in my view, need to go to an exclusive maximum. The thing I would say with respect to the trooper component, since that budget happened to come through my public safety subcommittee, is we are sensitive to that. And that, in my judgment, would be an argument that is appropriate to be made before the Department of Transportation when they would be considering raising a number on any sign out there on our highway. Among the considerations would be that if we didn't feel the new number could be enforced, then you don't raise it. So this is not a reason to object to the bill as currently written, in my view. As I indicated earlier, this simply provides Department of Transportation flexibility to take into consideration,
Mr. Chairman,
all kinds of these
things. Senator Carter.
Senator Miller.
Yes,
ma'am. Do I hear you saying that you feel as if 502 as it stands today should be the bill, if we're going to pass this bill, and that the argument that Sergeant Chastain is making, that it should be when the Department of Transportation has it and is going to be acting upon it, but and so not in some amendments before the bill is passed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, that's correct.
Okay. Then, Sergeant Chastain, then what you're saying by these amendments is that even if the department was to take this on as an issue directed by the legislature, that they should be in law before they get to you, so the argument does not take place in terms of the legitimacy of your actions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, yes.
I'm sorry.
Short answer, if you'd like me to...
Senator Carter, would you mind repeating that?
I said that Sergeant Chastain was he saying in terms of the Dashwood amendments that he felt that the appropriate behavior to take place if, in terms of this bill is not to wait, as the senator is saying, when the bill is passed and it goes to the department to make that argument, but should be in law before it gets to that point where the Department of Transportation has it.
Chair?
I'm hanging on.
Okay, Senator.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And this for the sergeant. Could you explain more in depth the justification for the 10-mile-an-hour differential between cars and trucks?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Messerly, our current laws have a 10-mile speed differential. We are not seeing a large problem with the 10-mile differential at 55 to 65. And that was the component for having the 60 to 70, 60 for trucks, 70 for cars, was the same argument that there's not a big problem with that 10-mile differential. Thus, it was left with the 10-mile differential.
Other questions for any other witnesses?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Might I just add, give the committee some comfort level.
We're looking for that. So.
Well, sometimes I know that it seems like we agonize over these things, and I realize that we have slogans from the tourism department that we are unique here, and truly we are, as only Iowa and Oregon states, the only two states west of the Mississippi that have not raised their speed limits since the federal government got out of our face. I think that the citizens of this state are intelligent enough to drive their vehicles in a safe manner, and I would suggest to those of you who drive on I-5 as I do every day that we are in session, that it just continues this farce to believe that we are somehow in accordance with a 65-mile-per-hour posting. That's just ludicrous, and it insults, I think, both law enforcement as well as our motorists, who by the nature of their behavior to the 85th percentile are deemed lawbreakers. It's just nuts.
I have a question, and the sergeant won't listen. What speed do you drive coming down?
I would take the fifth if I were you.
No, I'd be glad to answer that, Mr. Chairman. I drive at a reasonable rate of speed, for which I have not been cited.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your
as of yet.
Until this session ends.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I was very interested in what Mr. Russell had to say because I've received several emails, amazingly, in the last few weeks about truck drivers that drive across all states, and they talk about the fact of the speed differential being an unsafe issue. And I've seen many cars cut right in front of a truck where they've had to really put their brakes on and vice versa. So I was interested in your testimony about that, but the main thing is passenger cars do hit trucks a lot. Thank you.
Other questions for?
One question,
yes,
for Bob Russell. So you want the bill amended to what end?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, our two major issues. Number one, trucks should not go over 65 miles an hour. Our second issue is there shouldn't be more than a 5-mile-an-hour differential between trucks and cars. And that puts cars at 70.
So if that's what the Dashwood Amendment do, Senator Miller, is that still a problem for you? You don't want the Dashwood Amendment?
I'm not interested in the Dashwood Amendment simply because this is my preference, and the committee can make its decision, but the 75, again, is merely the maximum degree of flexibility that we will allow Department of Transportation. There is no requirement that they post 75. 70 may be their conclusion. The governor, in discussions with his office, has apparently determined that 70 is the speed they would be comfortable posting. You know, I think that's probably going to be the experience if this bill is passed in this form or with the amendment. my larger concern, quite frankly, is over the difference between the basic rule and the maximum speeds. And my preference would be that we keep the current system with basic rule as opposed to passing this bill as opposed to passing the dash ones. If the dash ones are before this committee, I would suggest you forget the whole matter.
You know, I didn't see ODOT signing up, but Troy, I believe you are here. Do you have any comments you'd like to make from the Department of Transportation?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Sergeant Justine, why don't you stay up there, too? We're not through with you, I don't think, yet.
Members of the committee, my name is Troy Casales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And not much to add from the quick debate. I think the presenters have really gotten down to the crux of the matter and have presented to you two or in some cases three sides to what the issue is. We have been involved with the governor's office, as Sergeant Chastain mentioned, regarding the Dash 1 amendments. We did provide testimony on the original Senate Bill 502 in previous committee at that time that talked about how that the governor was uncomfortable with raising the speed limits as proposed in that bill, plus two others that were being heard at that time in one combined hearing in March. There's really nothing more to add other than to say you've heard some of the evidence from all sides.
As a safety person from the Department of Transportation, what would be your ideal recommendation for transportation speeds for vehicles and for trucks in the state of Oregon? You're the expert.
Mr. Chairman, the Dash 1 amendments include in them elements from a safety point of view that we forwarded. First, by creating limits on all roads, what will happen between drivers, law enforcement, and courts, the traveling speed will be closer to that number if it is a limit than if it is a number that is known to be basic rule.
You want to eliminate the basic rule for that part of it?
Mr. Chairman, no. Basic rule in the Dash 1 amendments exists not only for below the posted number, but above. Basic rule stays as is in current law. If the sign is giving you a limit, it is going to be unlikely that officers are going to cite basic rule when that driver is going to be above that sign. They will more often than not use a limit and not a basic rule. However, they do have the option to use basic rule above the posted sign.
Give me an example of basic rule versus maximum.
On what road, Gibbard? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter. An example, the way the basic rule and speed limits are set up now depends on where that highway lies. If it's within an urban growth boundary, that's the same highway can change from a speed limit and change into a violation of the basic rule by crossing that arbitrary line on a map. So by creating the Dash 1 amendments and making all posted speeds limits, there's not the confusion between am I exceeding the speed limit or am I violating the basic rule.
So let me ask a question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go right ahead.
My indulgence, please. So if I'm getting on I-5 and I drive within the speed limit from Portland to, say, Wilsonville, and that posted speed limit, basic rule, is 60 miles an hour, but then I might speed up and be caught at 70. The discretion is what is different? What is different in terms of basic rule and maximum?
The discretion is there for speeds both lower and higher than the posted speed.
Okay.
The discretion in your example would be within the urban growth boundaries of that freeway. It is a violation of the basic rule. Once you leave the urban growth boundary, then it becomes a violation of the speed limit. So the discretion within the area you...
Is that the way it is, or
currently,
the way you're proposing?
No, the proposed amendment to the bill would say the posted speed is a limit.
Is a limit.
And the example that Senator Carter gave, her travel within that urban growth boundary, the city limits of urban growth boundary, is all violation of the basic rule. Once you leave the urban growth boundary, then it becomes a violation of the maximum speed limit, which is 65. So that's the differentiation between the two on the same highway.
Yes, Senator.
The way the bill reads now, without the Dash 1 amendments, I don't know if you're familiar with the highway between Bend and Burns, 120 miles approximately straight out through the sagebrush. Would this bill, without the Dash 1 amendments, allow you to go faster than the 55, or will you still be going 55? As the bill stands now, without the Dash 1.
Mr. Chair, Senator Clarino, I believe in the, without the Dash 1 amendments, it would be a violation of the basic rule still.
Senator Miller, we'll have to talk. That's a long stretch of highway that 55 miles an hour is probably not what people travel. And what about, let's say, if I might, Mr. Chair, between Bend and Redmond, is that considered a highway in which the bill without the Dash 1 amendments, this would increase the speed limit?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Clarino, without the amendment, that would remain violation of the basic rule. In the Dash 1 amendment, that would authorize Oregon Department of Transportation to increase speeds on both of those highways to 60 miles an hour.
Okay.
So, excuse me, using her example, Bend to Burns. On a clear day, traffic is just moving, you know, it's not heavy traffic. If Senator Clarno drives at 63 miles an hour between Bend and Burns right now, with the basic rule concept, is she probably okay?
Mr. Chairman, the violation of the basic rule would be the law that is prevailing on that highway, and an officer would then need to prove in court that there was other circumstances then existing that would cause the speed, I believe you said 63, to be in violation of an unsafe speed.
Now, at what point does the basic rule kick in? Let's say she is going 66 miles an hour in that. I know this is splitting hairs, but it gets to be kind of an important issue. If she's going 66 in that 55-mile zone.
Mr. Chairman, that is the one piece that is difficult with violation of the basic rule. Officers have used what their courts deem as an unsafe speed if there's no other conditions existing, and for the most part that is running right around 15 miles an hour over the posted designated speed.
So you could go up to 70 possibly, or 69. Right?
And that's just because of the way the courts have ruled on citations for violations.
Have you noticed that courts vary around the state? Does it depend upon the judge?
Mr. Chair, I assume they do. Depending on the judge and depending on the courts.
I paid the price.
Yes, Senator
Mr. Chairman,
Miller.
Thank you for allowing me to speak again. The basic rule, if you're driving over the number and you are cited for violation of the basic rule, then you must go into the courthouse and prove that your conduct was reasonable. You may rebut the prima facie case that the state has established through the citation that your conduct was unreasonable. But the burden is on the driver. The state doesn't have to prove squat. They just write the ticket. And how many motorists, in your case, who might live in Portland, who drove to Burns, are going back over to that jurisdiction to dispute? Or maybe they can do it by writing, but that's not necessarily very effective. So the practical matter is that most of these citations that are issued, then the courts are going to honor the citation. In the maximum speed case, the only issue is did you exceed the number? It has nothing to do with how reasonable your behavior was. It has everything to do with the number. You could be absolutely reasonable driving to Burns at 62 miles per hour, but you would be lawfully cited for violating the maximum speed by 7 miles per hour, and there is no defense unless you suggested that the radar was inaccurate or that somehow their tracking equipment was not accurate. Otherwise, you're toast. And that's a fact.
Mr. Chair, but to clarify, your bill would not allow the change in speed from base violation of the basic rule, which is currently on Highway 20. Your bill would not allow that speed, ODOT, to change that speed limit.
My bill intends to allow ODOT to change that number, yes.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to get.
And also retain basic rule, not to invite you to go faster than a realistically posted number, but as you well know, the number currently posted is ridiculous.
Well, I think, Senator Miller, you're absolutely right. I had the occasion to go a couple of days ago to Portland, and there's didn't seem to be anyone on the highway going 65 because they were all passing me. But the same thing can be very true out in Highway 20 that I'm speaking of, and I don't want to just be specific to something that's in my district, but most people do not travel the basic rule speed on that highway. It's 120 miles straight out there, and there's, you know, maybe you see a couple cars in an hour. So it's not something in which people are obeying the law either there.
We'll not ask you what speed you drive either.
No,
I would rather. Mr. Chairman, I might add, and this is one of the reasons I have pursued this bill for more than one session, is my oldest son used to be in law enforcement. And I have an awful lot of respect for the job that we ask our officers to do. And we have put them in an impossible position to ask them to enforce a law that nobody respects or obeys. And when one of these officers pulls you over and says that I'm going to cite you for driving on I-5 for 73 miles per hour, how do you feel about that officer? Not very good. But he's only doing the job that we have asked him to do, and what I'm suggesting we do in our law is conform the law to the reasonable behavior of our drivers so that this officer can have a little better and more respected job.
Okay, I have two questions I'm going to ask, and then I'm going to, unless the committee wants to, I'm going to close the public hearing. And I also want to apologize to those of you for the next bill, where this has taken a little bit longer than anticipated. And if any member of the legislature has to get back to a committee, let us know, and we'll try to accommodate you as quickly as we can, because I do know you're sneaking away from committees. And you're doing the same thing, Senator. I have two questions for you, Sergeant. You didn't talk about why you want the maximum speed instead of the basic rule. I haven't heard you talk about that. Maybe you did and I missed it. And the other one, does the basic rule make more officers have to go to court to uphold the citation with the basic rule?
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons for having a speed limit for all locations, the first and foremost reason, is it simplifies and clarifies for everybody. You see the sign, that's the speed limit. You don't have to try to figure out, am I in a speed limit area? Am I in a violation of basic rule area? Secondly, we know that transition or carryover speeds from interstates where the speed limit is higher, changing over into other state routes, other state highways, the speeds tend to creep up because of the faster speed that was traveled on the highway where the faster speed was allowed. And to have the speed limit there, then motorists know that when they transition from speed limit on an interstate to a speed limit on a secondary route, that posted speed is the limit that they need to be traveling. And
thank you. Are there any questions for any of the witnesses? Anyone else want to testify on this bill? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing right now on Senate Bill 502, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Do we need to ask our officers to stay around? Will there be some other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your time. And it does prove that this probably needs a lot of work because it is confusing. It really is. Okay. I'm going to open a public. No, excuse me. I have two members of the House, I believe, here to testify. What kind of a time schedule are you on, Representative Devlin?
You're on the floor.
Mr. Chairman, actually, Representative Devlin and I are on the same schedule because we're actually not.
So you're not doing much over there than anything else. All right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to open the public hearing right now on
3403.
House Bill 3403. I'll open the public hearing right now and let you guys leave. Then I'm going to go into about a 10-minute recess, so you'll all know the time schedule. And but to accommodate you to get you back on the floor so we can get all those good bills over here, we'll hear. Is it Representative Backlund and Representative Devlin? Would you come forward?
Let me see if I can find out what they decided.
Okay. Representative, I have a question for you. Have you and Representative Nolan been talking about an amendment that she will be bringing to us?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
We have that here.
Will you? Are you comfortable with it?
Yes, her amendment. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, I understand. That's the only one I was talking
about.
Oh, the dash A3s are at your place. Okay. Thank you very much. Well, go ahead, Representative Backlund. Then.
Thank you, Senator Duncan. Senator Duncan and members of this committee, for the record, I'm Vic Backlund, representative from District 33, which is North Salem and Kaiser, and I'm appearing today on behalf of House Bill 3403-A. I was the chair of the Student Achievement and School Accountability Committee. We heard this bill. And it passed out of our committee by an 8-1 vote. It passed the House floor by a 56-2 vote. I must say, too, that initially I was not real enthusiastic about House Bill 3403. I had assumed that most school districts, in fact all school districts, already had a disciplinary policy that would encompass harassment, intimidation, or bullying. But when we heard the testimony, I found out that many school districts do not have a policy in this regard. And I even called the Salem-Kaiser superintendent's office and asked what we had, and I was assured that we did not have a complete policy and that, in fact, the superintendent's office favored House Bill 3403. So with that background, I have come to the point where I think it's a good bill. I think it's a good thing that school districts do provide or do come up with policies relating to harassment, intimidation, or bullying. And certainly Representative Devlin has been the workhorse on this bill, and he has been the catalyst to get it to this point. And I think probably with that, I should turn it over to Representative Devlin. And I would thank him for bringing this bill to our committee.
Thank you, Representative Backlund.
Thank you very much, Representative Backlund.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I very much appreciate the opportunity of having this hearing. When this was heard in the House, we actually brought about 15 people to testify, but given this the date in the session and the fact that you don't know a week in advance when a bill is going to come up, we only have a few people here today. What I would like to do is basically give some testimony and then answer any questions that you might have. House Bill 3403 would require each school district in Oregon to adopt a policy against intimidation, bullying, or harassment. While this bill does not require every school district to adopt the same policy, it does require school districts to bring their policies up to par with a few minimum standards. I believe very strongly that children have a right to feel safe at home and while at school. As legislators, the responsibility rests at least partially on our shoulders to ensure that public schools are safe and secure learning environments. I recognize that bullying, harassment, intimidation have been present in our schools for as long as any of us present can remember. However, many recent events have shown quantitatively that our schools have changed dramatically in the last decade. When I was in school, it was common for students to be harassed each other. However, when I was in school, other factors in society made it rare for students to be bullied and harassed to the breaking point. Many students today are afraid to go to school. Some young victims are so afraid that they sneak weapons into our schools because they feel they need to protect themselves. Signs of increasing school violence are everywhere. The causes of this increase are complicated, and I'm not under any illusion that House Bill 3403 will be a magic fix to our problems with school violence.
However, I do believe it is a very important step in the right direction. Many other states, and I'll digress from my written testimony here because I know it's late in the session, but many other states have considered similar legislation. Colorado has passed legislation recently of this type. Washington was actually the model for this legislation. They introduced it in their prior session. It did not go too far in their prior session. They introduced it in this session, and actually in this session, it had the support of the governor, the attorney general, the superintendent of public instruction, and 49 co-sponsors. And it's passed one of their chambers, but now it's being considered in the other. You have my written testimony, so I won't go into detail into that because I know how sometimes Senate committees react a little bit differently from House committees, and sometimes House committees it's acceptable to read testimony, and sometimes it's not as acceptable in Senate committees, so I try to modify my testimony appropriately. One of the things that we did that some people thought was creative in the House committee that I didn't have time to do for this committee was I didn't have time to go out and review all 198 policies for every school district in the state or every individual policy for each of their high schools and middle schools. But what I did do in the House committee was we went out and reviewed all the policies I could find for all the members of the House committee that I would be presenting the bill to. And I pointed out to them where some of the bills had, some of their school districts had good policies in some areas, they were lacking in others. And in fact, we found no school district that actually had a complete policy. Some would, you know, take a complaint but had no process for how to investigate a complaint. Some would take a complaint, have a process for investigating it, but not really have any clear sort of resolution to how complaints were resolved. And I think that demonstrated to the committee one of the common issues that comes back every time I present this bill is, aren't school districts doing this already? And the reality is that many school districts have done exemplary jobs. Many school districts have not. What this bill basically sets in place is a requirement to put in a policy for intimidation, bullying, harassment, and then gives some very clear guidelines for what that policy should include, but gives an enormous amount of latitude to the individual school district and the individual school within the school district to modify that policy in accordance with their individual needs. As we all recognize, those 198 entities have their own, they have their own boards. Most of us view that the local control issue in schools is particularly important, and this provides for local control in schools. I've also provided a number of different items here with the testimony. There are a couple of items, two letters of parties that appeared before the House committee I have included in the testimony, a Ms. Barbara Arcand and also a Ms. Vicki Shilos. Also, I would want to state for the record that the Oregon School Boards Association is supportive of the bill. They're supportive of Representative Nolan's A3 amendments. They are obviously not supportive of the -4s or the -5 amendments. The Attorney General's office has also expressed support for the bill. In fact, I believe Ms. Granger is here from the Attorney General's office to testify if she gets a chance to their support. The Oregon Education Association is supportive of the bill. We've actually received more calls, letters, emails about this bill than any other bill that I've ever introduced. And I think that's probably true for many members of the Education Committee have received many emails, calls, letters. We think it's a very well-constructed bill. We'll do a great deal of benefit to the children of this state that are in school. I know that there may be an attempt to try to put something in this bill in terms of the A4, A5 amendments. I want to say for the record that I'm sympathetic to the issues that they're trying to present. In fact, for the record, I am the co-sponsor of the similar bill in the House that's similar to SB 85, but is the corresponding House bill to that. But at this particular point in time, this bill has a life, and this bill has a very good chance of passage. I think will do a lot of benefit for Oregon's children. I am just very worried about attaching something to it, which will basically, to be just as blunt as I can be, put the Oregon School Boards Association in the position from right now supporting the bill to very strongly opposing it should the -4, -5 amendments make it into the bill. I urge your passage of the bill onto the floor for a due pass recommendation.
Okay, thank you.
May I also say to your representative, Mr. Chairman,
yes,
that the senator that plans to maybe possibly add an amendment also has a vote.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I always recognize that.
I I have a question I'd like to ask. Are you two going to stay around for a few minutes?
I can stay for a few minutes.
Okay, the question I have is, I noticed originally you had the superintendent of public instruction developing a model policy, and I think I like what you've done, leaving it to each local district to meet their own requirements. But I look at so many things that have been done in the Legislative Assembly, and I see really no enforcement of the thing. It says you must do it, but okay, so what? There are many statutes on the books, and I can assure you school districts do not follow those. I guess I'm wondering why you do ask them to transmit a copy to the superintendent of public instruction, but why did you consider asking the superintendent of public instruction to ensure that school districts did develop a policy?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that was an area of the original bill that was debated quite a bit. There were a lot of parties that didn't feel it was appropriate to have the superintendent of public instruction develop a model policy.
No, I understand that part. No, I think that's right. I guess my question...
And then, Mr. Chairman, secondarily, the reason we had them actually provide a copy of their policy was, one, so that they ensure that the law was being met, but two, that there are school districts at all different levels in terms of their current compliance with the issues in this, and we felt by providing policies to the superintendent, it would make them available to other school districts and might make it easier for them to comply with the ultimate policy. We did not actually provide any mechanism other than a requirement that they put a policy in place in terms of an enforcement mechanism. No, we did not.
Well, the reason I say that is that if you ask that the superintendent ensure that that happens in their standardization or their school visitation, that can be a criterion by which the district is evaluated. This has no enforcement. I'm just pointing that out, and I was curious why that was. Because I've just seen so many things through the years that were done this way, and people say, fine, you know, so what, I'll send something in, but or not do it at all. But the superintendent has no responsibility except to accept the copy that comes in. So there's no enforcement.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard and all of you in the presenting panel, I've served 14 years on the school board, so I've been in the position where you try to deal with these kind of issues myself, personally. And I'm a little bit troubled that this bill requires, as opposed to encourages, or in some way provides some kind of incentive. And I'm also would be interested if there's programs that have educated through the superintendent's office or through the school board's association or through the labor groups that have encouraged school districts to develop a plan. It seems to me like there's a tremendous opportunity for education as to the need, the necessity, and how to go about it. And I've always thought that in a case such as this, a tremendous incentive is when the insurance agents require that, unless your insurance rates are going to go up or something. I'm not getting the sense that there's been this kind of activity going on to try to encourage it without mandating it through through the legislative process.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Messerly, what we tried to do in the bill, when you look at the original version of the bill, is the original version of the bill required a policy to be put in place prohibiting intimidation, harassment, and bullying. Then beyond that, though, it required the policy to address very specific areas, and it had a lot of latitude originally in it, but the agreement we reached with the Oregon School Boards Association was to keep the original requirement, which was the requirement that they develop a policy, and then for each individual component, they encouraged that the policy include each of those components. So the requirement is basically to have the broad policy, and the encouragement is that the policy address these areas. One of the things that we found, and to cite a specific example to one of my own districts, is my own superintendent from one of my districts, a party that some of you are very familiar with, Dr. Korach from the Lake Oswego School District. His original reaction to this, well, we're already doing this. And then I asked him if he would please, you know, have his staff look at the policy. And he said, yes, he'd do that, and he'd get back to me. Well, he got back to me a few days later and said, well, we're actually only doing part of this. And actually, we would be more than interested in actually reviewing our policies and trying to make them cover some of these broader areas. So I think he was fine with the original requirement to have a policy. He just didn't want every single aspect to be dictated, but he recognized that by listing those areas that had to be, should be covered, that it provided a lot of guidance to school districts. And actually, this bill has had an enormous amount of research that I've stolen from the Washington legislature. So we think it's very well written, and we have accommodated a lot of the interests that had some issues with the bill originally. In fact, we, I think, brought it to the Senate without any opposition at all. So
I'm going to ask if Representative Nolan could make some comments now on the bill. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for hearing House Bill 3403 and for giving me the opportunity to speak in favor of this important proposal. And I want to wholeheartedly commend my colleague, Representative Devlin, for introducing the bill, which will address some of the needs, and by no means all of the needs, that were identified and brought to light by Attorney General Hardy Meyer's interim coalition task force on safety in Oregon schools. And just as one example of the pieces that are addressed in that evaluation, the coalition tells us that bullying, harassment, and mean-spirited teasing remain substantial concerns. And nationally, nearly 40% of middle and high school students report that bullying, harassment, and mean-spirited teasing negatively affect their academic performance, their attendance, or their peer relationships. And as we know, this pattern of chronic negative interactions is strongly correlated with more serious forms of violence and delinquency in schools and communities. So I hope we can bring this forward as part of assuring that we have safe schools in Oregon. I wanted to speak to you about one very specific aspect of this bill. As we considered this bill on the House side in the Student Achievement and School Accountability Committee, we identified some concerns about the ability to consistently apply some of the language in Section 2. And working with the chief sponsor and other interested parties, we propose to make that section consistent instead with ORS 342.700, which is the section of statute that addresses school district policies on sexual harassment. And the reason we wanted to make it consistent there is because that language is already proven, already used by school districts, and the meaning of that language is known across the state already. So we brought forward to you the Dash A3 amendments, which modify the bill in three rather minor ways but improve its clarity. It rewrites Section 2 to conform, as I said, with existing statute. Specifically, it's similar to ORS 342.704. It clarifies that school district policy definitions should be consistent with this state statute. And finally, it clarifies that school district policies should identify the school official who is responsible for implementing the policy. I would very much appreciate your support of that amendment and your support of House Bill 3403. If you have any questions, I'll answer them. And since I didn't do this at the beginning, for the record, I am Mary Nolan, State Representative from House District 11.
Thank you very much, Representative Nolan. Questions for either Representative Devlin or Representative Nolan? Okay, thank you. I'm going to recess the work session. Recess the public hearing for about, I'll tell you, we're going to come back at 4:15. I'm going to bang the gavel at 4:15, right on the nose, okay? We are in recess.